Disc 8. On March 4th, Washington thanked Hamilton for his frank letter and confessed that he had not fathomed the abysmal state of America's finances. He referred gravely to the contemplative hours he had spent on the subject of the soldiers' pay. The sufferings of a complaining army on one hand, and the inability of Congress and tardiness of the states on the other, are the forebodings of evil. Washington then obliquely rebuffed Hamilton's misguided suggestion that he exploit army discontent to goad Congress into action on public finance, saying it might excite jealousy and bring on its concomitants. With unerring foresight, Washington perceived the importance of enshrining the principle that military power should be subordinated to civilian control. The Newburgh situation grew only more incendiary. In the following days, two anonymous letters made the rounds in camp, fomenting opposition to Washington and rallying the officers to apply force against Congress. One document warned darkly, "Suspect the man who would advise to more moderation and longer forbearance." It seemed as if the new nation might be lurching toward a military putsch. On March 12th, Washington, alarmed by the state of affairs, told Hamilton that he would attend an officers' meeting on March 15th to stop them from plunging themselves into a gulf of civil horror from which there might be no receding. Washington kept his diplomatic balance, trying to head off rash action by his officers while pleading for timely congressional relief. "Let me beseech you, therefore, my good sir," he told Hamilton, "to urge this matter earnestly and without further delay. The situation of these gentlemen, I do verily believe, is distressing beyond description." On March 15th, Washington addressed the officers, determined to squash a reported scheme to march on Congress. For the first time, he confronted a hostile audience of his own men. Washington sternly rebuked talk of rebellion, saying it would threaten the liberties for which they had fought. "An insurrection would only open the floodgates of civil discord and deluge our rising empire in blood." He then staged the most famous coup de théâtre of his career. He was about to read aloud a letter from a congressman when the words swam before his eyes, so he fished in his pockets for his glasses. "Gentlemen," he said, "you will permit me to put on my spectacles, for I have not only grown gray but almost blind in service to my country." The mutinous soldiers, inexpressibly moved, were shamed by their opposition to Washington and restored to their senses. Washington agreed to lobby Congress on their behalf, and a committee chaired by Hamilton granted the officers a pension payment equivalent to 5 years' full pay. Whether Congress could really make good on such payments without its own taxing power was another question. As soon as he heard of Washington's virtuoso performance, Hamilton applauded him. "Your Excellency has, in my opinion, acted wisely. The best way is ever not to attempt to stem a torrent, but to divert it. You coincide in opinion with me on the conduct proper to be observed by yourself." Washington had heeded Hamilton's advice in assuming a leadership role, but had pointedly ignored his advice about inflaming the situation for political ends. Hamilton still clung to the notion that a convincing bluff of armed force could help spur congressional action, but that was as far as he would venture. "As to any combination of force," he observed, "it would only be productive of the horrors of a civil war, might end in the ruin of the country, and would certainly end in the ruin of the army." The feared mutiny at Newburgh deepened but also complicated relations between Hamilton and Washington. It reinforced their mutual conviction that the Articles of Confederation had to be revised root and branch and Congress strengthened. "More than half the perplexities I have experienced in the course of my command, and almost the whole of the difficulties and distress of the army, have their origin here," Washington wrote of congressional weakness. At the same time, Washington saw a certain Machiavellian streak in Hamilton and bluntly told him of grumbling in the army about congressmen who tried to use the soldiers as mere puppets to establish continental funds. He lectured Hamilton, "The army is a dangerous instrument to play with." Washington must have seen that Hamilton, for all his brains and daring, sometimes lacked judgment and had to be supervised carefully. On the other hand, Hamilton had employed his wiles in the service of ideals that Washington himself endorsed. In the spring of 1783, Alexander Hamilton, 28, already stood near the pinnacle of national affairs. He chaired a military committee that hatched the first plan for a peacetime army under the aegis of the federal government. In early April, Congress named him chairman of the committee in charge of peace arrangements, equipped with a spacious mandate to investigate ways to provide a system for foreign affairs, for Indian affairs, for military and naval peace establishments, in Madison's words. That month, Congress ratified the Provisional Peace Treaty with Britain, marking an end to 8 years of hostilities. News that only amplified the menacing clamor among soldiers who wanted to pocket their pay before going home. "And here, my dear Colonel Hamilton," Washington wrote, "let me assure you that it would not be more difficult to still the raging billows in a tempestuous gale than to convince the officers of this army of the justice or policy of paying men in civil offices full wages when they cannot obtain a 60th part of their dues." Even though Congress enacted a new system of import duties that April, Hamilton still feared that it would lack the requisite funds to pacify the army. When Robert Morris threatened to quit as superintendent of finance in May, Hamilton was among those enlisted to persuade him to stay until the army could be safely disbanded. He introduced an emergency resolution asking the states to send money to the common treasury so the soldiers could be paid and demobilized. In mid-June, the raging billows that Washington had warned about still surged and foamed. Rebellious troops in Philadelphia sent a petition to Congress, couched in threatening language, demanding their money. 2 days later, word came that 80 armed soldiers were marching from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, to Philadelphia to pry loose the pay owed to them. Their surly ranks swelled as they advanced. Hamilton, now Congress's man for all seasons, was swiftly drafted into a three-man committee to fend off the threat. He and his colleagues appealed to Pennsylvania's Supreme Executive Council to send local militiamen to stop these soldiers before they reached Philadelphia and made common cause with troops in local barracks. Hamilton was irate when the state refused to act until some outrage was perpetrated. Unafraid to lead, he stepped into the void fearlessly and directed Major William Jackson, Assistant Secretary at War, to intercept the rowdy protesters before they reached the city line. "You will represent to them with coolness but energy the impropriety of such irregular proceedings," he instructed, "and the danger they will run by persisting in an improper conduct." The troops, brushing Jackson aside, poured into Philadelphia on June 20th, banded together with fractious troops in city barracks, and seized control of several arsenals. The next day, Elias Boudinot, President of Congress and Hamilton's erstwhile sponsor, convened a special Saturday afternoon session of Congress to deal with the worsening crisis. That morning, Boudinot heard reports that rebel troops might sack the local bank. The congressmen were scarcely seated when about 400 rebel soldiers, bayonets stabbing the air, encircled the State House, where Congress and the state's Supreme Executive Council occupied separate chambers. Things looked ominous. The mutineers far surpassed in number loyal troops guarding the doors. The symbolism was especially troubling. A mob of drunken soldiers had besieged the people's delegates in the building where the Declaration of Independence had been signed. The congressmen did not fear premeditated violence, Madison reported, but it was observed that spirituous drink from the tippling houses adjoining began to be liberally served out to the soldiers and might lead to hasty excesses. The increasingly drunken troops sent a scolding petition to the delegates inside, insisting that they be allowed to choose their own officers and threatening to unleash an enraged soldiery unless their demands were met within 20 minutes. The delegates refused to submit to such blackmail, shorten their session, or negotiate with rabble. After 3 hours, the embattled congressman marched out of the State House to the sneers and taunts of rioters. As he emerged, Hamilton saw embodied his worst nightmare. A portion of the Revolutionary Army had broken down into a mob that was intimidating an enfeebled central government. Now it was Hamilton, like Washington 3 months before, who made a vigorous case for military subordination to civilian rule. "The licentiousness of an army is to be dreaded in every government," he later commented. "But in a republic, it is more particularly to be restrained, and when directed against the civil authority, to be checked with energy and punished with severity." The situation made him again wonder how a spirited young democracy could generate the respect necessary for the rule of law to endure. That evening, Elias Boudinot assembled congressmen at his home. They passed a defiant resolution written by Hamilton claiming that government authority had been grossly insulted by the rioters and demanding that effectual measures be immediately taken for supporting the public authority. If Pennsylvania persisted in its spineless inaction, Congress would relocate to Trenton or Princeton. By no coincidence, the scene of famous patriotic victories. The next morning, Hamilton and Oliver Ellsworth delivered this blunt ultimatum to John Dickinson, now the president of the Supreme Executive Council. If Pennsylvania could not guarantee the safety of Congress, then it would suspend all further meetings in the city. After his encounter with the council, Hamilton lost all hope that the state would send out the militia, and he submitted a chilling report to Congress. The mutineers, he noted, had selected their own officers to present their grievances and authorized them to use force, even threatening them with death in case of their failing to execute their views. Aghast at the weak and disgusting behavior of Pennsylvania's leaders at a moment demanding unequivocal action, Hamilton reluctantly concluded and Congress agreed that they should adjourn to Princeton by Thursday. In short order, Congress fled across the state line and set up a movable capital in Princeton. The delegates settled crankily into cramped makeshift quarters, Madison sharing a bed with another delegate in a room scarcely larger than 10 feet square. Most shocking to this bibliophile, it lacked a desk. "I am obliged to write in a position that scarcely admits the use of any of my limbs," he complained. So primitive were the Princeton lodgings that 1 month later, Congress, like a French medieval court in the hunting season, packed up again and moved to Annapolis, followed by Trenton 1 year later, then New York City in 1785. Of this runaway Congress, hounded from its home, Benjamin Rush said that it was abused, laughed at, and cursed in every company. True to Hamilton's prediction, the insurrection collapsed as soon as resolute action was undertaken. The Pennsylvania Council tardily called up 500 militiamen. Once the mutineers learned of an approaching detachment, they laid down their arms, and the Lancaster contingent trudged back to their base. A perpetual magnet for controversy, Hamilton was stung by charges that he had conspired to move the capital from Philadelphia as part of a plot to transfer it to New York. In fact, Hamilton had feared that if Congress decamped, it would dilute domestic respect for its authority and sully America's image abroad. On July 2nd, he seconded a resolution that Congress should return to Philadelphia and prodded Madison for a statement confirming that he had postponed the flight to Princeton until the very last instant. Like an attorney collecting affidavits in a lawsuit, Hamilton asked his colleague, "Did I appear to wish to hasten it, or did I not rather show a strong decision to procrastinate it?" Madison obliged with a letter. Yes, Hamilton had stalled until the last moment. Once again, the thin-skinned Hamilton was quick to refute insinuations of duplicity or self-interest. Convinced that appearances, not reality, ruled in politics, he never wanted to allow misimpressions to linger, however briefly, in the air. The Philadelphia Mutiny had major repercussions in American history, for it gave rise to the notion that the national capital should be housed in a special federal district where it would never stand at the mercy of state governments. For Hamilton, the episode only heightened his dismay over the Confederation Congress and the folly of relying on state militia. On the other hand, he thought Congress had been unfairly blamed for failing to fulfill its duties when it was consistently deprived of the means of doing so. Its flagrant weaknesses stemmed from its constitution, not from its administration. By the time the Pennsylvania mutineers dispersed, Hamilton had endured 7 weary months in Congress, a period that had taxed his energy and patience. That 3 of New York's 5 delegates had been absent much of the time only added to his heavy burden. He had concluded that the country was not ready to amend the risible Articles of Confederation because local and state politics exerted too dominant an influence. Experience must convince us that our present establishments are utopian before we shall be ready to part with them for better, he told Nathaniel Greene. While marking time in Princeton in July, Hamilton drafted a resolution that again called for a convention to revise the Articles of Confederation. This prescient document encapsulated many features of the 1787 Constitution, a federal government with powers separated among legislative, executive, and judicial branches, and a Congress with the power to levy taxes and raise an army. Hamilton again questioned the doctrine of free trade when he argued for federal regulation of trade so that injurious branches of commerce might be discouraged, favorable branches encouraged, and useful products and manufactures promoted. With his hyperactive mind, Hamilton was already fleshing out a rough draft of America's future government. Yet, with the war ending, many advocates of state sovereignty wanted Congress dismantled as a permanent body. They thought the current Congress was too strong. "The constant session of Congress cannot be necessary in times of peace," said Thomas Jefferson, who wanted to replace it with a committee. Slowly but inexorably, the future battle lines were being drawn between those who wanted an energetic central government and those who wanted rights to revert to the states. When his draft resolution foundered, Hamilton saw no need to dawdle any longer in this dwindling, demoralized Congress. On July 22nd, he informed Eliza that once the definitive peace treaty arrived, he would join her. "I give you joy, my angel, of the happy conclusion of the important work in which your country has been engaged. Now, in a very short time, I hope we shall be happily settled in New York." Hamilton was dragooned into riding back to Albany with the dour Mrs. Schuyler, who insisted on making a detour through New York City. This stopover gave Hamilton a queasy foretaste of the tensions brewing between returning patriots and British sympathizers. He was scandalized by the flight of Tory businessmen. 7,000 had sailed for Nova Scotia in April alone, and feared the economic wreckage that might ensue from this large-scale exodus. When he got back to Albany, a shaken Hamilton wrote to Robert R. Livingston, "Many merchants of second class, characters of no political consequence, each of whom may carry away 8,000 or 10,000 guineas, have, I am told, applied for shipping to convey them away. Our state will feel for 20 years at least the effect of the popular frenzy." For more than a century, November 25, 1783, was commemorated in New York City as Evacuation Day, the blessed end to 7 years of British rule and martial law. At the southern tip of Manhattan, in a spiteful parting gesture, sullen redcoats greased the fort's flagpole as the last British troops were ferried out to transport ships waiting in the harbor. Once the British had relinquished their hold over this last outpost of occupied soil, the procession of American worthies entered, led by General Henry Knox, who hoisted the American flag up a newly pitched pole. Cannons rattled off a 13-gun salute, flags flapped, and crowds cheered in delirium as George Washington and Governor George Clinton, guarded by Westchester light cavalry, rode side by side into the city, followed by throngs of citizens and soldiers marching 8 abreast. The long, triumphant procession wound down to the Battery, taking in the roars of the ecstatic crowds packing the streets. America had been purged of the last vestiges of British rule. It had been a long and grueling experience. The 8 years of fighting counted as the country's longest conflict until Vietnam, and the cost had been exceedingly steep in blood and treasure. Gordon Wood has noted that the 25,000 American military deaths amounted to nearly 1% of the entire population, a percentage exceeded only by the Civil War. As Washington gazed at the crowds, he could observe on every street corner debris left by the war. The British had never rebuilt those sections of the town blighted by the giant conflagration of September 1776. The city was now a shanty town of tents and hovels, interspersed with skeletal ruins of mansions and hollowed-out dwellings. Cows roamed weedy streets rank with garbage. When the future mayor James Duane saw his old properties, he moaned that they look as if they had been inhabited by savages or wild beasts. To provide firewood for British troops, the city had been denuded of fences and trees, and the wharves stood rotting and decayed. "Noisome vapors arise from the mud left in the docks and slips at low water," said one visitor, "and unwholesome smells are occasioned by such a number of people being crowded together in so small a compass, almost like herrings in a barrel, most of them very dirty, and not a small number sick of some disease." Hamilton was already meditating a plan for removing this devastation. Instead of patching up derelict houses and building huts on vacant lots, he expressed hope that the city's mechanics and artisans would find profitable and durable employment in erecting large and elegant edifices. Less apparent but no less momentous than the physical change was the huge demographic shift triggered by the approaching peace. As British hopes of victory faded, many loyalists had crowded aboard convoys and escaped to Britain, Canada, and Bermuda. At the same time, there was a countervailing influx of patriots that doubled New York City's population from about 12,000 on Evacuation Day to 24,000 just 2 years later, making it a booming metropolis that surpassed Boston and Baltimore in size. The surge of new and returning residents drove up prices sharply for food, fuel, and lodging. During his stay of a little more than a week in New York, Washington salvaged the reputations of several suspected Tories who had engaged in espionage for the Patriots. Whether coincidentally or not, two were old acquaintances of Hamilton from King's College days. The morning after he entered New York, Washington breakfasted with the loquacious tailor Hercules Mulligan, who had spied on British officers visiting his shop. To wipe away any doubts about Mulligan's true loyalties, Washington pronounced him a true friend of liberty. Washington also strolled into the bookshop of the urbane printer James Rivington, who had been attacked by Isaac Sears and the Sons of Liberty when Hamilton was at King's. With the war over, Rivington tried to stay in business by deleting the word royal from his newspaper's name and the British arms from its masthead, but he finally had to suspend publication. In reality, he had done yeoman's work for the Patriots, having stolen the British fleet's signal book, which had been transmitted to Admiral de Grasse. Washington disappeared into a back room with Rivington under the guise of consulting some agricultural books and rewarded him with a bag of gold pieces. On December 4th, Washington made his tearful farewell to his officers at Francis Tavern at the corner of Broad and Pearl Streets, again underscoring that military officers were merely servants of the Republic. Washington resisted all calls to become a king. There is no proof that Hamilton attended the historic valedictory, in spite of his having been at Washington's side for 4 years of war. His absence, which must have been noted, suggests that he still nursed some secret wound because of his treatment by Washington. Certainly, Washington, of all people, would not have lacked the magnanimity to invite him. Afterward, trailed by speechless admirers, Washington strolled down Whitehall Street and boarded a barge that carried him to the New Jersey shore. Just a few days earlier, Alexander and Eliza Hamilton, along with baby Philip, had begun to rent a house at 57, later 58, Wall Street, not far from Francis Tavern. For the first time, the vagabond young man from the West Indies had a real hometown, a permanent address. By the standards of the day, Wall Street was a broad, elegant thoroughfare, and many of the best-known merchant families resided there. The Hamiltons lived on the less fashionable eastern end, which was full of shops and offices, while Aaron and Theodosia Burr lived at Tony 3 Wall Street, next door but one to the City Hall, at Wall and Broad, as Burr proudly put it. The lives of Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr continued in parallel. Both had passed the bar in Albany at almost the same time, and they now occupied the same New York street and inaugurated their legal practices at almost the same time. After so many years of war, Hamilton had a pressing need to earn money and tried to keep full-time politics at bay. A month after Evacuation Day, he spotted a newspaper item stating that he had been nominated for the New York Assembly. Hamilton politely but firmly deflected the honor. Being determined to decline public office, he wrote to the paper, "I think it proper to declare my determination to avoid in any degree distracting the votes of my fellow citizens." Local populists associated with the Sons of Liberty scored lopsided victories in the election, resulting in a spate of punitive measures against Tories. As a fierce opponent of such vengeance, Hamilton busied himself defending persecuted Tories and halting their banishment. Perhaps no individual was identified more with the post-war resurgence of New York City, not to mention the city's future greatness, than Alexander Hamilton. He was destined to excel in what was to emerge as America's commercial and financial metropolis, and he articulated the most expansive vision of its future. Nonetheless, his vision was imperfect. At a dinner party soon after Evacuation Day, Hamilton and some other educated young men fated to lead the city debated whether to invest in local real estate or unspoiled forest land upstate. Hamilton's son James told the tale. John Jay was in favor of New York and made purchases there, and as his means enabled him to hold his lots. His speculation made him rich. Some of the others, including my father, took the opposite view and invested in the lands in the northern counties of the state. The wild lands were purchased at a few cents an acre, but they were not settled very rapidly. This last sentence was a gross understatement. That Alexander Hamilton opted to purchase land in the far northern woods and bungled the chance to buy dirt-cheap Manhattan real estate must certainly count as one of his few egregious errors of economic judgment. Chapter 10. A grave, silent, strange sort of animal. From the time he started out as a young lawyer in post-war New York, Hamilton presented a dashing figure in society. He was trim and stylish, though not showy in dress. His account books reflect a concern with fashion, as shown by periodic visits to a French tailor, and his sartorial elegance is confirmed in portraits. In one painting, he wears a double-breasted coat with brass buttons and gilt-edged lapels, his neck swathed delicately in a ruffled lace jabot. One French historian remarked, he belonged to the age of manners and silk stockings and handsome shoe buckles. He was as fastidious as a courtier in caring for his reddish-brown hair, and his son James recorded his daily ritual with the barber. I recollect being in my father's office in New York when he was under the hands of his hairdresser, which was his daily course. His back hair was long. It was plaited, clubbed up, and tied with a black ribbon. His front hair was pomatumed, that is, pomaded, powdered, and combed up and back from his forehead. Many artists who painted Hamilton picked up the quiet smile that suffused his ruddy cheeks and shined in his close-set blue eyes, conveying an impression of mental keenness, inner amusement, and debonair insouciance. His strong, well-defined features, especially the sharply assertive nose and chin, made for a distinctive profile. Indeed, his family thought a profile, not a portrait, done by James Sharples, the best likeness of him ever done. Hamilton's friends liked to rhapsodize his charm. His Federalist ally, Fisher Ames, was to eulogize his great capacity for friendship by saying that he was so entirely the friend of his friends that his power over their affections was entire and lasted through his life. For Judge James Kent, who often rendered him in superlatives, Hamilton was blessed with a very amiable, generous, tender, and charitable disposition, and he had the most artless simplicity of any man I ever knew. It was impossible not to love as well as respect and admire him. Yet close observers also detected something contradictory in the way the mobile features shifted quickly from gravity to mirth. Boston lawyer William Sullivan noted the contrasting expressions of his face. When at rest, it had rather a severe and thoughtful expression, but when engaged in conversation, it easily assumed an attractive smile. This mixture of the grave and the playful was the very essence of his nature. His grandson wrote that Hamilton's personality was a mixture of aggressive force and infinite tenderness and amiability. In his early years, Hamilton drew much of his social sustenance from the small, clubby circle of New York lawyers. The New York Directory for 1786 listed approximately 40 people under the rubric Lawyers, Attorneys, and Notary Publics. The departure of many Tory lawyers had cleared the path for capable, ambitious men in their late 20s and early 30s, including Burr, Brockholst Livingston, Robert Troup, John Lawrence, and Morgan Lewis. They were constantly thrown together in and out of court. Much of the time they rode the circuit together, often accompanied by the judge, enduring long journeys in crude stagecoaches that jolted along bumpy upstate roads. They stayed in crowded, smoky inns and often had to share beds with one another, creating a camaraderie that survived many political battles. To assist with a caseload of mostly civil but also criminal work, Hamilton struck a partnership with Balthazar de Hurt, who was either his colleague or office manager for 3 years. Though he had just passed the bar himself, Hamilton was swamped with requests to coach aspiring lawyers, and he trained the sons of many prominent men, including John Adams. Hamilton struck his young charges as an exacting boss. One early trainee, Dirk Tenbrook, recruited straight from Yale, wrote a former classmate a mournful letter about clerking for the little dynamo. But now, instead of all the happiness once so near to view, I am deeply engaged in the study of law, the attaining of which requires the sacrifice of every pleasure and demands unremitted application. Heavy, for the most part, have been the hours to me. Notwithstanding later conspiracy talk that he had stashed away bribes from the British, Hamilton seemed relatively indifferent to money, and many contemporaries expressed amazement at his reasonable fees. The Duc de la Rochefoucauld-Liancourt commented, "The lack of interest in money, rare anywhere, but even rarer in America, is one of the most universally recognized traits of Mr. Hamilton, although his current practice is quite lucrative. I've heard his clients say that their sole quibble with him is the modesty of the fees that he asks." Robert Troup said that Hamilton rejected fees if they were larger than he thought warranted, and generally favored arbitration or amicable settlements in lieu of lawsuits. Hamilton's son James related two incidents that show his father's legal scruples. In one case, the executor of a Long Island estate tried to retain Hamilton to defend him against some heirs who were suing him. To soften him up, the man pushed a pile of gold pieces across Hamilton's writing table before stating his case. When he was done, Hamilton pushed the gold back to him and said, "I will not be retained by you in such a cause. Take your money, go home, and settle without delays with the heirs, as in justice you are bound to do." Another time he flatly refused the business of a certain Mr. Gouverneur after learning he had made disparaging remarks about the attorney-like way somebody had padded his bill. In a caustic note, Hamilton lectured Gouverneur that his behavior cannot be pleasing to any man in the profession, and that it must oblige anyone that has proper delicacy to decline the business of a person who professedly entertains such an idea of the conduct of this profession. As a lawyer in a humming seaport and financial hub, Hamilton dealt with innumerable suits over bills of exchange and maritime insurance. He also gravitated toward cases that established critical points of constitutional law. It would be a mistake, however, to think of Hamilton only as a cloud-wreathed Olympian lawyer. He sometimes represented poor people in criminal cases on a pro bono basis, or was paid with just a barrel of ham. He had an incorrigible weakness for aiding women in need. In December 1786, he defended a spinster, Barbara Ransomer, who was indicted for stealing fans, lace, and other costly items. "I asked her what defense she had," Hamilton recollected. "She replied that she had none." Unlike many modern lawyers, Hamilton represented clients only if he believed in their innocence. But he disobeyed his personal rule with Ransomer. In a speech dripping with shameless pathos, he managed to persuade the jury of her innocence. "Woman is weak and requires the protection of man," Hamilton summed up. "And upon this theme, I attempted to awaken the sympathies of the jury, and with such success that I obtained a verdict of not guilty. I then determined that I would never again take up a cause in which I was convinced I ought not to prevail." That same year, Hamilton represented George Turner, who was indicted as a dueler, fighter, and disturber of the peace, again suggesting that Hamilton was perhaps less averse to dueling than he later intimated. Hamilton was regarded as one of the premier lawyers of the early Republic and was certainly preeminent in New York. Judge Ambrose Spencer, who watched many legal titans pace his courtroom, pronounced Hamilton the greatest man this country ever produced. In power of reasoning, Hamilton was the equal of Daniel Webster, and more than this could be said of no man. In creative power, Hamilton was infinitely Webster's superior. A no less glowing encomium came from Joseph Story, a later Supreme Court justice. "I have heard Samuel Dexter, John Marshall, and Chancellor Robert R. Livingston say that Hamilton's reach of thought was so far beyond theirs that by his side they were schoolboys, rushed tapers before the sun at noonday." Whence the source of this legendary reputation? Hamilton had a taste for courtroom theatrics. He had a melodious voice coupled with a hypnotic gaze, and he could work himself up into a towering passion that held listeners enthralled. In January 1785, jurist James Kent watched Hamilton square off against Chancellor Robert R. Livingston, who was representing himself in a lawsuit claiming additional land south of his vast estate on the Hudson. The position of chancellor was one of the top judicial positions in the state. A member of New York's most powerful family, Livingston was tall and confident and moved with the natural grace of a born aristocrat. In comparison, Hamilton's style seemed almost feverish. "He appeared to be agitated with intense reflection," Kent recalled. "His lips were in constant motion and his pen rapidly employed during the chancellor's address to the court. He rose with dignity and spoke for perhaps 2 hours in support of his motion. His reply was fluent and accompanied with great earnestness of manner and emphasis of expression." In speech, no less than in writing, Hamilton's fluency frequently shaded into excess. Hamilton had the most durable pair of lungs in the New York bar and could speak extemporaneously in perfectly formed paragraphs for hours. But it was not always advantageous to have a brain bubbling with ideas. Robert Troup complained that the prolix Hamilton never knew when to stop. "I used to tell him that he was not content with knocking his opponent in the head, but that he persisted until he had banished every little insect that buzzed around his ears." Troop also speculated that Hamilton was so distracted by public matters later on that he never had the chance to become deeply read in the law. This was probably true. On the other hand, the myriad claims on his time forced Hamilton to avoid trivia and plumb the basic principles of a case. With other men, law is a trade. With him, it was a science, said Fisher Ames. He forced other lawyers to fight on his turf, starting out with a painstaking definition of terms and then reciting a long string of precedents. He brought into court lengthy lists of legal authorities and Latin quotations he wished to cite. His sources were varied, esoteric, and unpredictable. His legal editor, Julius Goebel Jr., has observed, Hamilton's reading was not confined to English law, for in addition to citations to basic Roman law texts, we find him proffering passages from exotics like the Frenchman Dumas, the Dutchman Vinius, and the Spaniard Perez. A good-natured legal rivalry arose between Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr. Sometimes they worked on the same team, more often on opposing sides. Hamilton did not drag political feuds into dinner parties and drawing rooms, and so he mingled with Burr cordially. Later on, Hamilton said that in their early relationship they had always been opposed in politics, but always on good terms. We set out in the practice of the law at the same time and took opposite political directions. Burr beckoned me to follow him, and I advised him to come with me. We could not agree. Burr's friend, Commodore Thomas Truxton, verified this rapport in non-political matters. I always observed in both a disposition when together to make time agreeable at the houses of each other and of friends. Burr and Hamilton supped at each other's homes, and Burr's wife, Theodosia, visited Eliza. In 1786, the two men helped to finance the Erasmus Hall Academy in Flatbush, the forerunner of Erasmus Hall High School, today the oldest secondary school in New York State. Many weird coincidences stamped the lives of Hamilton and Burr, yet their origins were quite dissimilar. Burr embodied the old aristocracy, such as it then existed in America, and Hamilton the new meritocracy. Born on February 6, 1756, 1 year after Hamilton, Burr boasted an illustrious lineage. His maternal grandfather was Jonathan Edwards, the esteemed Calvinist theologian and New England's foremost cleric. Edwards's third daughter, Esther, married the Reverend Aaron Burr, a classical scholar and theologian who became president of Princeton. The infant Burr was born into the most secure and privileged of childhoods, yet it was steeped in horror. At the time of Burr's birth, the college was moving from Newark to Princeton, and in late 1756, the family took up residence in the new president's house. Then came a nightmarish chain of events. In September 1757, Aaron Burr Sr. died at 42 and was replaced 5 months later as president by his father-in-law, Jonathan Edwards. Soon after arriving, Edwards was greeted with the news that his own father, a Connecticut clergyman, had died. Princeton had recently been struck by smallpox, which Edwards promptly contracted by inoculation, dying 2 weeks after settling in. Then Burr's mother, Esther, came down with smallpox and died 2 weeks after her father. Dr. William Shippen took Burr and his orphan sister into his Philadelphia home. When Grandmother Edwards came to reclaim the children, she contracted virulent dysentery and died shortly afterward. Thus, by October 1758, 2-year-old Aaron Burr had already lost a mother, a father, a grandfather, a grandmother, and a great-grandfather. Though he lacked any memory of these gruesome events, Burr was even more emphatically orphaned than Hamilton. Raised in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, and Elizabethtown, New Jersey, by his uncle, the Reverend Timothy Edwards, Burr attended the same Presbyterian academy that later educated Hamilton. Entering Princeton at 13, he developed into a first-rate scholar and delivered a commencement speech entitled Building Castles in the Air, in which he declaimed against frittering away energy on idle dreams. Burr studied law with his brother-in-law, the Connecticut jurist Tapping Reeve, then fought courageously in the Revolution. Like Hamilton, the impeccably tailored Burr made an elegant impression, with his lustrous dark eyes, full lips, and boldly arched eyebrows. He was witty, urbane, and unflappable, and had a mesmerizing effect on men and women alike. Despite his later courtship of the Jeffersonians, Burr never shed a certain patrician hauteur, Epicurean tastes, and a faint disdain for money-making activities. He believed that through self-control he could learn to control others. With his impervious aplomb, he was a better listener than talker. Hamilton was easy to ruffle, whereas Burr hid his feelings behind an enigmatic facade. When faced with confessions of wrongdoing, Burr said coolly, "No apologies or explanations. I hate them." Unlike Hamilton, he could store up silent grievances over extended periods. Throughout his career, Hamilton was outspoken to a fault, while Burr was a man of ingrained secrecy. He gloried in his sphinx-like reputation and once described himself thus in the third person. "He is a grave, silent, strange sort of animal, inasmuch that we know not what to make of him." As a politician, Burr usually spoke to one person at a time and then in confidence. Starting in college, he wrote coded letters to his sister and classmates and never entirely discarded the self-protective habit. Nor did he commit ideas to paper. Senator William Plumer remarked, "Burr's habits have been never to trust himself on paper, if he could avoid it, and when he wrote, it was with great caution." As Burr once warned his law clerk, "Things written remain." This caution reflected Burr's principal quality as a politician. He was a chameleon who evaded clear-cut positions on most issues and was a genius at studied ambiguity. In his wickedly mordant world, everything was reduced to clever small talk, and he enjoyed saying funny, shocking things. "We die reasonably fast," he wrote during a yellow fever outbreak in New York. "But then Mrs. Smith had twins this morning, so the account is even." By contrast, Hamilton's writings are so earnest that one yearns for some frivolous chatter to lighten the mood. It is puzzling that Aaron Burr is sometimes classified among the founding fathers. Washington, Jefferson, Madison, Adams, Franklin, and Hamilton all left behind papers that run to dozens of thick volumes, packed with profound ruminations. They fought for high ideals. By contrast, Burr's editors have been able to eke out just two volumes of his letters, many full of gossip, tittle-tattle, hilarious anecdotes, and racy asides about his sexual escapades. He produced no major papers on policy matters, constitutional issues, or government institutions. Where Hamilton was often more interested in policy than politics, Burr seemed interested only in politics. At a time of tremendous ideological cleavages, Burr was an agile opportunist who maneuvered for advantage among colleagues of fixed political views. Hamilton asked rhetorically about Burr, "Is it a recommendation to have no theory?" "Can that man be a systematic or able statesman who has none? I believe not." In a still more severe indictment, Hamilton said of Burr, "In civil life, he has never projected nor aided in producing a single measure of important public utility." Burr's failure to make any notable contribution in public policy is mystifying for such a bright, literate man. He was an omnivorous reader. The records of the New York Society Library show that in 1790, Burr read 9 consecutive volumes of Voltaire. He then spent a year and a half poring over all 44 volumes of Modern Universal History. How many men at the time both read and ardently recommended Mary Wollstonecraft's feminist tract, A Vindication of the Rights of Woman? "Be assured," he told his educated wife, Theodosia, "that your sex has in her an able advocate. It is, in my opinion, a work of genius." Yet this same Burr could take cruel swipes at his wife, responding to one of her letters with the acid remark that her note had been truly one of the most stupid I had ever the honor to receive from you. If not a deep thinker as a politician, Burr was a proficient lawyer who vied with Hamilton for standing at the New York bar. He knew that Hamilton was the better orator, despite his sometimes windy bombast. He also said that anyone who tried to compete with Hamilton on paper was lost. Nevertheless, some of Burr's associates thought he was the superior lawyer, a man who went straight to the nub of the matter. As a lawyer and as a scholar, Burr was not inferior to Hamilton, insisted General Erastus Root. His reasoning powers were at least equal. Their modes of argument were very different. I used to say of them, when they were rivals at the bar, that Burr would say as much in half an hour as Hamilton in 2 hours. Burr was terse and convincing, while Hamilton was flowing and rapturous. Hamilton smothered opponents with arguments, while Burr resorted to cunning ruses and unexpected tricks to carry the day. Though Hamilton appreciated that Burr could be resourceful in court, he found something empty beneath the surface. It is certain that at the bar he is more remarkable for ingenuity and dexterity than for sound judgment or good logic, he said. On another occasion, Hamilton elaborated on this critique. His arguments at the bar were concise. His address was pleasing. His manners were more. They were fascinating. When I analyzed his arguments, I could never discern in what his greatness consisted. Hamilton venerated the law, while Burr often seemed mildly bored and cynical about it. The law is whatever is successfully argued and plausibly maintained, he stated. That the competition between Hamilton and Burr originated in their early days in legal practice is confirmed by a tale told by James Parton, an early Burr biographer. The first time that the two men jointly defended a client, the question came up as to who would speak first and who would sum up. Protocol stipulated that the lead attorney would do the summation, and Hamilton wished to be the one. Burr was so offended by this patent vanity that in his opening speech he tried to anticipate all the points that Hamilton would likely make. Apparently he was so effective at this that Hamilton, embarrassed, had nothing to say at the end. If the story is true, it was one of the few times that Alexander Hamilton was ever left speechless. As a New York lawyer, Hamilton was well positioned to help the country negotiate the passage from the rosy flush of revolution to the sober rule of law. The management of the peace, he knew, would be no less perilous a task than the conduct of the war. Could the fractious tendencies engendered by years of fighting be channeled in constructive directions? The revolution had unified sharply disparate groups. Without the bonds of wartime comradeship, would the divisive poles of class, region, and ideology tear the new country apart? These questions took on special urgency in New York, the former citadel of the British Army. Even before the war, the enthusiasm for revolution had often seemed more tepid in New York than elsewhere, and the state had been occupied by British forces longer than any other. Hamilton knew that many New Yorkers had been fence-sitters or outright Tories during the war and regretted to see the British depart. To Robert Morris, Hamilton surmised of New Yorkers that at the war's outbreak, near one half of them were avowedly more attached to Great Britain than to their liberty. There still remains, I dare say, a third whose secret wishes are on the side of the enemy. Many patriots found it hard to sympathize with the loyalists, who were often well-to-do Anglican merchants and members of the old social elite. To aggravate matters, New York City had witnessed many British atrocities. Hordes of American soldiers had been incarcerated aboard lice-ridden British prison ships anchored in the East River. A staggering 11,000 patriots had perished aboard these ships from filth, disease, malnutrition, and savage mistreatment. For many years, bones of the dead washed up on shore. How could New Yorkers forgive such unspeakable deeds? During Hamilton's tour of the city in August 1783, street corner scuffles were already commonplace as returning veterans demanded back rent or damage awards from residents who had occupied their properties during the war. For many patriots, the Tories were traitors pure and simple, and they would fight anyone who sought to stop them from exacting revenge. Alexander Hamilton became that brave, unfortunate target. His motives for such martyrdom have long stirred debate. Cynics scoffed that he had acquired a long list of rich loyalist clients and peddled his soul for British gold. Another theory portrayed him as the pawn of patriotic landowners who dreaded an upsurge of post-war radicalism and wanted to make common cause with conservative Tories. After all, if the patriots could pounce on Tory estates, might not their own fiefdoms be next? Many Hudson River grandees had enjoyed social and business contracts with wealthy loyalists before the war and viewed them as potential allies in the post-war era. And Hamilton did indeed later forge an alliance of progressive landowners and former Tories into the nucleus of the Federalist Party in New York. The full truth of Hamilton's motivation for defending loyalists is complex. He thought America's character would be defined by how it treated its vanquished enemies, and he wanted to graduate from bitter wartime grievances to the forgiving posture of peace. Revenge had always frightened him, and class envy and mob violence had long been his bugaboos. There were also economic reasons for his stand. He regretted the loss of capital siphoned off by departing Tories, and feared the sacrifice of trading ties vital to New York's future as a major seaport. He also maintained that the nation's survival depended upon support from its propertied class, which was being hounded, spat upon, and booted from New York. Hamilton's crusade on behalf of injured loyalists was also spurred by foreign policy concerns. With the war over, he craved American respectability in Europe. "The Tories are almost as much pitied in these countries as they are execrated in ours," John Jay advised him from France. "An undue degree of severity towards them would therefore be impolitic as well as unjustifiable." For Hamilton, the anti-Tory legislation in New York flouted the peace treaty with Britain, which stipulated that Congress should earnestly recommend to state legislatures that they make restitution for seized Tory property and refrain from future confiscations. The treatment of the Tories sensitized Hamilton to the extraordinary danger of allowing state laws to supersede national treaties, making manifest the need for a constitution that would be the supreme law of the land. For him, the vendetta against New York's Tories threatened the whole political, economic, and constitutional edifice that he visualized for America. During the war, the New York legislature had passed a series of laws that stripped Tories of their properties and privileges. The 1779 Confiscation Act provided for the seizure of Tory estates, and the 1782 Citation Act made it difficult for British creditors to collect money from Republican debtors. In March 1783, the legislature enacted the statute that most engrossed Hamilton, the Trespass Act, which allowed patriots who had left properties behind enemy lines to sue anyone who had occupied, damaged, or destroyed them. Other laws barred loyalists from professions, oppressed them with taxes, and robbed them of civil and financial rights. Each of these acts had rabid constituencies. Those who had enriched themselves by buying Tory estates mouthed the rhetoric of liberty while profiting handsomely from their convictions. Revenge, greed, resentment, envy, and patriotism made for an inflammatory mix. By early 1784, the city had erupted in a wave of reprisals against Tories, who were tarred and feathered. The patriotic press clamored that those who had stayed behind British lines during the war should leave the city voluntarily or be banished. Fearing a Tory stampede, Hamilton did what he always did in emergencies. He took up his pen and protested the anti-Tory legislation in his first Letter from Phocion, published in the New York Packet. In plucking the name Phocion from Plutarch, Hamilton cleverly alluded to his own life as well as to antiquity. Phocion was an Athenian soldier of murky parentage who came from another country and became an aide to a great general. Later, as a general himself, the iconoclastic Phocion favored reconciliation with the defeated enemies of Athens. In the essay, Hamilton said that as a revolutionary veteran, he had too deep a share in the common exertions of this revolution to be willing to see its fruits blasted by the violence of rash or unprincipled men, without at least protesting against their designs. He railed against the baleful precedent that would be set if the legislature exiled an entire category of people without hearings or trials. If that happened, no man can be safe, nor know when he may be the innocent victim of a prevailing faction. The name of liberty applied to such a government would be a mockery of common sense. Hamilton disputed the rhetoric of Tory baiters and said categorically that they were motivated by little, vindictive, selfish, mean passions. To those who thought to profit by driving out Tories, Hamilton cautioned that this strategy would backfire on merchants and workmen alike. "To the trader," they say, "you will be overborne by the large capitals of the Tory merchants. To the mechanic, your business will be less profitable, your wages less considerable by the interference of Tory workmen." In fact, Hamilton noted, traders would be denied credit once extended to them by Tory merchants, and mechanics would find that temporarily higher wages either drew more mechanics to New York or slashed demand for their services, returning wages to their former level. Hamilton insisted that the now chastened Tories would prove faithful friends of the new government. Time was to validate his optimism. Many people were shocked that Alexander Hamilton, Washington's ex-adjutant, had taken up the Loyalist cause, even though Washington, too, preached mercy toward their former enemies. Hamilton's actions abruptly altered his image. He was accused of betraying the revolution and tarnishing his bright promise, and it took courage for him to contest such frenzied emotion. An anonymous poem appeared in the papers that lampooned Hamilton as Lysander, once most hopeful child of fame. The writer, a former admirer, lamented that after gallant wartime service, Hamilton had stooped to become a lackey for the loyalists. "Wilt thou, Lysander, at this well-earned height, forget thy merits and thy thirst of fame? Descend to learn of law her arts and sleight, and for a job to damn your honored name?" In spite of Hamilton's pleas for tolerance, the persecution of Tories intensified. At a huge meeting on the Common called by the revivified Sons of Liberty in March, speakers urged the massive crowd to expel all Tories by May 1st and asked the state legislature to approve a resolution denying restoration of their citizenship. Dismayed by this turmoil, Hamilton entered the lists again with a second letter from Phocion, reminding his fellow citizens that actions taken now would reverberate into the future. "'Tis with governments as with individuals. First impressions and early habits give a lasting bias to the temper and character." All mankind was watching the Republican experiment. "The world has its eye upon America. The noble struggle we have made in the cause of liberty has occasioned a kind of revolution in human sentiment." If America acted wisely, Hamilton believed, it had a historic opportunity to refute the skeptics of democracy and to doom despots everywhere. Unfortunately, the two Phocion articles did not halt the reign of vengeance. On May 12, 1784, the state legislature passed a law depriving most loyalists of the vote for the next 2 years. For Hamilton, it was a horrifying breach of the peace treaty and boded ill for America's domestic harmony and relations abroad. But he was not intimidated into silence. The feisty Hamilton always reacted to controversy with stubborn grit and a certain perverse delight in his own iconoclasm. He never shrank from a good fight. By the second Phocion letter, Hamilton was defending a rich Tory in a celebrated lawsuit that showed just how far he would go to champion an unpopular cause. He was not a politician seeking popularity, but a statesman determined to change minds. In 1776, a patriotic widow, Elizabeth Rutgers, had fled the British occupation of New York, abandoning her family's large brewery and alehouse on Maiden Lane. As of then, the Rutgerses had parlayed their brewing fortune into a 100-acre estate. 2 years later, a couple of British merchants, Benjamin Waddington and Evelyn Pierpont, took over the brewery at the prompting of the British Army and appointed Joshua Waddington its supervisor. By that time, the property had been so thoroughly scavenged that it was stripped of everything of any value except an old copper vessel, two old pumps, and a leaden cistern full of holes, Benjamin Waddington later testified. To refurbish and reopen the idle brewery, the new operators spent £700 for a new storehouse, stable, and woodshed, and they paid rent to the British Army after 1780. On November 23, 1783, 2 days before Washington entered New York, a fire had incinerated the brewery, causing nearly £4,000 in losses for its wartime owners. Invoking the Trespass Act, Elizabeth Rutgers filed suit in the mayor's court of New York City, demanding £8,000 in back rent from Joshua Waddington. As an aggrieved widow, Mrs. Rutgers aroused intense sympathy, and Hamilton was villainized as a turncoat and a crypto-Tory. But he thought the Rutgers lawsuit an ideal test case to challenge the legality of the Trespass Act. Unlike many Tory tenants who had vandalized properties during the war, Joshua Waddington had taken a crumbling property and restored it at considerable expense. When Mrs. Rutgers calculated the back rent Waddington owed her, she made no allowance for this investment. Also, Waddington had acted under the express authority of the British Army at a time when the city lay under martial law. Arguments in Rutgers v. Waddington were presented on June 29, 1784, before five aldermen and two figures well known to Hamilton, Mayor James Duane and City Recorder, Vice Mayor Richard Varick. John Adams described Duane as a man with a sly, surveying eye, a little squint-eyed, very sensible, I think, and very artful. A smart lawyer of Irish ancestry, Duane had married into the Livingston family, corresponded with Hamilton during the Revolution, and then given him the run of his law library. Richard Varick, tall and dignified, with a bald pate and keen eyes, had been an aide to Philip Schuyler and Benedict Arnold, and had been with Hamilton when Mrs. Arnold performed her mad scene on the Hudson. If the odds seemed stacked in Hamilton's favor, especially with two competent co-counsels in Brockholst Livingston and Morgan Lewis, Mrs. Rutgers also fielded a distinguished legal team that included her nephew, Attorney General Egbert Benson, John Lawrence, and Hamilton's King's College friend Robert Troop. Even in a crowd of six other outstanding lawyers, Hamilton gave a cogent exposition that soared far above all competition, said James Kent, then a law clerk for Benson. The audience listened with admiration for his impassioned eloquence. As he strode about James Duane's chamber, Hamilton articulated fundamental concepts that he later expanded upon in the Federalist Papers, concepts central to the future of American jurisprudence. In renting the property to Waddington, he declared, the British had abided by the law of nations, which allowed for the wartime use of property in occupied territory. New York's Trespass Act violated both the Law of Nations and the 1783 Peace Treaty with England, which had been ratified by Congress. In urging the court to invalidate the Trespass Act, Hamilton expounded the all-important doctrine of judicial review, the notion that high courts had a right to scrutinize laws and, if necessary, declare them void. To appreciate the originality of this argument, we must recall that the country still lacked a federal judiciary. The state legislatures had been deemed the most perfect expression of the popular will and were supposed to possess supreme power. Mrs. Rutgers's lawyers asserted state supremacy and said congressional action could not bind the New York legislature. At bottom, Rutgers v. Waddington addressed fundamental questions of political power in the new country. Would a treaty ratified by Congress trump state law? Could the judiciary override the legislature? And would America function as a true country or a loose federation of states? Hamilton left no doubt that states should bow to a central government. It must be conceded that the legislature of one state cannot repeal the law of the United States. When Duane delivered his verdict in mid-August, he commended Hamilton and the other lawyers, applauding the arguments on both sides as elaborate and the authorities numerous. He handed down a split verdict that required Waddington to pay back rent to Rutgers, but only for the period before he started paying rent to the British Army in 1780. Given the pent-up emotion surrounding the case, Hamilton advised his client to negotiate a compromise with Rutgers, who settled for about £800, much less than the £8,000 she had initially sought. It was a smashing triumph for Hamilton, who had upheld the Law of Nations. A mere 9 months after Evacuation Day, he had won a real, if partial, victory for a rich British subject against a patriotic widow. Hamilton knew the case would be a boon to his legal practice, which went full throttle in defending Tories. During the next 3 years, he handled 45 cases under the Trespass Act and another 20 under the Confiscation and Citation Acts. His victory also brought predictable notoriety in its wake. The radical press fulminated against him for giving aid to the most abandoned scoundrels in the universe, and rumors floated about of a cabal intent upon assassinating him. The scandal-mongering journalist James Cheatham later observed of Hamilton that a great majority of the loyalists in the state of New York owe the restoration of their property solely to the exertions of this able orator. The tone of politics had rapidly grown very harsh. Some poison was released into the American political atmosphere that was not put back into the bottle for a generation. As after any revolution, purists were vigilant for signs of ideological backsliding and departures from the one true faith. The 1780s and 1790s were to be especially rich in feverish witch hunts for traitors who allegedly sought to reverse the verdict of the war. For the radicals of the day, revolutionary purity meant a strong legislature that would overshadow a weak executive and judiciary. For Hamilton, this could only invite legislative tyranny. Rutgers v. Waddington represented his first major chance to expound the principle that the judiciary should enjoy co-equal status with the other two branches of government. If Rutgers v. Waddington made Hamilton a controversial figure in city politics in 1784, the founding of the Bank of New York cast him in a more conciliatory role. The creation of New York's first bank was a formative moment in the city's rise as a world financial center. Banking was still a new phenomenon in America. The first such chartered institution, the Bank of North America, had been started in Philadelphia in 1781, and Hamilton had studied its affairs closely. It was the brainchild of Robert Morris, and its two biggest shareholders were Jeremiah Wadsworth and Hamilton's brother-in-law, John B. Church. These two men now cast about for fresh outlets for their capital. In 1783, John Church sailed for Europe with Angelica and their four children to settle wartime accounts with the French government. In his absence, Church named Hamilton as his American business agent, a task that was to consume a good deal of his time in coming years. When Church and Wadsworth deputized him to set up a private bank in New York, Hamilton warmed to it as a project that could help to rejuvenate New York commerce. He was stymied by a competing proposal from Robert R. Livingston to set up a land bank, so-called because the initial capital would be pledged mostly in land, an idea Hamilton derided as a wild and impracticable scheme. Since land is not a liquid asset and cannot be converted into ready cash in an emergency, Hamilton favored a more conservative bank that would conduct business exclusively in notes and gold and silver coins. When Livingston solicited the New York legislature for a charter, the tireless Hamilton swung into action and mobilized New York's merchants against the measure. He informed Church that he had lobbied some of the most intelligent merchants, who presently saw the matter in a proper light and began to take measures to defeat the plan. Hamilton was more persuasive than he realized, and a delegation of business leaders soon approached him to subscribe to a money bank that would thwart Livingston's land bank. "I was a little embarrassed how to act," Hamilton confessed sheepishly to Church, "but upon the whole I concluded it best to fall in with them." Instead of launching a separate bank, Hamilton decided to represent Church and Wadsworth on the board of the new bank. Ironically, he held in his own name only a single share of the bank that was long to be associated with his memory. On February 23, 1784, the New York Packet announced a landmark gathering. "It appearing to be the disposition of the gentlemen in the city to establish a bank on liberal principles, they are therefore hereby invited to meet tomorrow evening at 6 o'clock at the Merchants' Coffee House, where a plan will be submitted to their consideration." At the meeting, General Alexander McDougal was voted the new bank's chairman and Hamilton a director. Snatching an interval of leisure during the next 3 weeks, Hamilton drafted single-handedly a constitution for the new institution, the sort of Herculean feat that seems almost commonplace in his life. As architect of New York's first financial firm, he could sketch freely on a blank slate. The resulting document was taken up as the pattern for many subsequent bank charters and helped to define the rudiments of American banking. In the superheated arena of state politics, the bank generated fierce controversy among those upstate rural interests who wanted a land bank and believed that a money bank would benefit urban merchants to their detriment. Within the city, however, the cause of the Bank of New York made improbable bedfellows, reconciling radicals and loyalists who were sparring over the treatment of confiscated wartime properties. McDougal was a certified revolutionary hero, while the Scottish-born cashier, the punctilious and corpulent William Seton, was a loyalist who spent the war in the city. In a striking show of bipartisan unity, the most vociferous Sons of Liberty, Marinus Willett, Isaac Sears, and John Lamb, appended their names to the bank's petition for a state charter. As a triple power at the new bank, a director, the author of its constitution, and its attorney, Hamilton straddled a critical nexus of economic power. One of Hamilton's motivations in backing the bank was to introduce order into the manic universe of American currency. By the end of the Revolution, it took $167 in continental dollars to buy $1 worth of gold and silver. This worthless currency had been superseded by new paper currency, but the states also issued bills, and large batches of New Jersey and Pennsylvania paper swamped Manhattan. Shopkeepers had to be veritable mathematical wizards to figure out the fluctuating values of the varied bills and coins in circulation. Congress adopted the dollar as the official monetary unit in 1785, but for many years New York shopkeepers still quoted prices in pounds, shillings, and pence. The city was awash with strange foreign coins bearing exotic names. Spanish doubloons, British and French guineas, Prussian carolines, Portuguese moidores. To make matters worse, exchange rates differed from state to state. Hamilton hoped that the Bank of New York would counter all this chaos by issuing its own notes and also listing the current exchange rates for the miscellaneous currencies. Many Americans still regarded banking as a black, unfathomable art, and it was anathema to upstate populists. The Bank of New York was denounced by some as the cat's paw of British capitalists. Hamilton's petition to the state legislature for a bank charter was denied for 7 years, as Governor George Clinton succumbed to the prejudices of his agricultural constituents who thought the bank would give preferential treatment to merchants and shut out farmers. Clinton distrusted corporations as shady plots against the populace, foreshadowing the Jeffersonian revulsion against Hamilton's economic programs. The upshot was that in June 1784, the Bank of New York opened as a private bank without a charter. It occupied the Walton Mansion on St. George's Square, now Pearl Street, a three-story building of yellow brick and brown trim, and 3 years later it relocated to Hanover Square. It was to house the personal bank accounts of both Alexander Hamilton and John Jay, and prove one of Hamilton's most durable monuments, becoming the oldest stock traded on the New York Stock Exchange. Chapter 11. Ghosts. After the dreary saga of his own childhood, Hamilton wanted a large, buoyant clan, and Dr. Samuel Bard, the family physician, was kept in constant motion with Eliza bringing one little Hamilton after another into the world. On September 25, 1784, the Hamiltons had their first daughter named Angelica in honor of Eliza's sister. Not until Hamilton's fourth and favorite child, James Alexander, came along in 1788 did they christen a baby in homage to the absentee grandfather in the Caribbean. Hamilton never named a child after his mother Rachel, perhaps hinting at some residual bitterness toward her. In all, Alexander and Eliza produced 8 children in a 20-year span. As a result, Eliza was either pregnant or consumed with child-rearing throughout their marriage, which may have encouraged Hamilton's womanizing. After their third child, Alexander, was born on May 16, 1786, the Hamiltons performed an exceptional act of kindness that has long been overlooked. They added an orphan child to their burgeoning brood. Colonel Edward Antill, a King's College graduate and Revolutionary War veteran, had foundered as a lawyer and farmer after the war. When his wife died in 1785, he was grief-stricken and encumbered with 6 children. By 1787, after suffering a breakdown, he committed his 2-year-old daughter Fanny to the Hamiltons, who took the bright, cheerful girl into their home. Edward Antill died 2 years later, so Alexander and Eliza kept the child until she was 12, when she went to live with a married sister. She was educated and treated in all respects as Hamilton's own daughter, and married Mr. Arthur Tappan, an eminent philanthropist of New York, said son James. From London, Angelica Church cheered on her saintly sister, telling Hamilton, "All the graces you have been pleased to adorn me with fade before the generous and benevolent action of my sister in taking the orphan Antill under her protection." That Eliza married one orphan, adopted another, and co-founded an orphanage points up a special compassion for abandoned children that might explain, beyond his obvious merits, her initial attraction to Hamilton. For 10 years, the Hamiltons had a home at 57, then 58, Wall Street. A sketch of this bygone Wall Street shows a prosperous thoroughfare lined with 3-story brick buildings. Well-dressed people saunter down brick sidewalks and roll in carriages over cobblestones at a time when many lanes were still unpaved. The young couple lived comfortably enough and entertained often, although Hamilton's business records reveal numerous small loans from friends to tide them over. One of his first purchases after leaving the army bespoke the convivial host. He bought decanters, 2 ale glasses, and a 12 wine glasses. The vivacious Hamiltons stood high on the supper and dinner list compiled by Sarah and John Jay when they settled at 8 Broadway after returning from France in 1784. Very fond of drama, Alexander and Eliza were also frequently habitués of the Park Theater on Lower Broadway. Like her husband, Eliza was frugal and industrious, even if often apparelled in the rich clothes of a society lady. Skilled in many domestic arts, she made handbags and potholders, arranged flowers and wove table mats, designed patterns for furniture, cooked sweetmeats and pastry, and sewed undergarments for the children. She served plentiful meals of mutton, fowl, and veal, garnished with generous portions of potatoes and turnips, and topped off with fresh apples and pears. The Hamiltons were treated to fresh produce shipped regularly from Albany by the Schuylers, and there were always demijohns of good wine on hand. An acute disappointment of the Hamiltons' early married life was their constant separation from Angelica by the Atlantic Ocean. End of Disc 8.